Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today as we visit with Melinda Myers. Great to have her back. She's a nationally known gardening expert, TV radio host, author, columnist, over 30 years of horticulture experience. She's written over 20 gardening books, and I really like her re-released second edition of Midwest Gardener's Handbook. It's a dandy. It's I think the subtitle is All You Need to Know to Plant, to Plan, Plant, and Maintain a Midwest Garden. So we'll talk with her about how to have a great garden this year, no matter your experience, the size of your budget, or how much space you have. And I hope you'll join in with your questions. What gardening problems are you dealing with or thinking about? Are you looking for ways to garden in a small space, perhaps? What other questions are on your mind? You can join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Melinda Myers, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Always a pleasure, Larry. And we actually have a beautiful day, most of us anyway, to talk gardening.
I'm wondering if we're losing listeners today for the outside.
Hey, I have my work clothes on ready to blast out when we're done, so I can relate.
Oh, man. Well, we're going to talk about getting great results in your garden, but first, you have got a really cool collaboration with local libraries, and I looked through the news release from your shop, and it looks fantastic. Tell us about it.
You know, the libraries are perfect partners for me. They're all about educating, inspiring, serving their patrons, and excuse me. And they're great partners to help get information out. So thanks to sponsorship by We Energies, we were able to team up with the public libraries of Wisconsin and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, but anyone can access. So if we have listeners, I know you do, from many, many states, you can go to my website, melindamyers.com, and check out all the resources. So we've got a six-month period of promoting ways that you can save money when you garden, be environmentally friendly as you garden, and then have fun along the way, and of course, be successful. So for April, May, we're encouraging gardeners to share their seeds. Many already do this, right? I had a friend, we had dinner together, and he goes, oh, I have some extra basil seeds. Here, you need these, right? And so we can share plants that we, you know, buy a flat of whatever or a six-pack of tomatoes and split it among you and your friends because maybe you only need two, but it's much cheaper if you buy a six-pack and you all spend less money. So just that's what we've kind of focused on in April, May. I've done two webinars, so the recordings are available on my website. One was Grow a Bountiful Garden on limited time, space, and energy, and money, of course. And then just the other night, we did one, Gardening in a Changing Climate. We're going to do grow a tomato in a pot in June. We were going to go on a bug hunt with all the members of the family in July, a little worm composting in August, and environmentally friendly landscaping webinar in September. So just trying to help gardeners boost their success, have fun along the way, and, of course, as always, learn something. And that's why the libraries are such great partners.
Yeah, it's great. I think any library in the state or all libraries in the state, what do you think?
Yeah, good thing. So anyone can access the information. What I recommend you do is when you visit your local library, ask how they're participating because some of them have book lists for reading. Some are including some special books in the summer reading program. Some are having their own local events to supplement. And, you know, if you ask, a lot of them have helped us advertise the program. And libraries, I'll tell you, I started my career early speaking at libraries when I was an extension agent, so they're near and dear to my heart. But one of the things I found over the last few years as we've teamed up is the librarians are so creative. You know, you give them an idea and they take it a direction that I'd never imagine, and their enthusiasm and creativity is great. So check with your local library. But anyone can access the videos, the activity sheets. We're adding them as the season goes, but through my website. But check with your library because I know many are doing some special activities for families, for adults, for children, for any of their patrons. So ask. I'm always impressed.
Okay. I am as well. They're a great bunch of people. I'm impressed every time I go to different libraries. I've given some talks at libraries as well, and I'm always amazed at how nice they are and how smart they are. They come up with some really good ideas.
Exactly.
Well, we already have a number of callers online, so let's take a call from Eugene in Viola to begin. Let's go there. Hi, Eugene. Well,
can you use that whole dad for planting tomato plants and pepper plants?
We missed the first part of your comment,
right,
Eugene.
A hodad. Can you use a hodad for planting tomato plants and pepper plants?
Is this almost like a post hole digger? Is that?
No. It's like an axe. You go out on the end. You use it for planting trees. You drop it in, and you pull back on it, and you slide your plant in your tree behind the plant.
Gotcha.
And you pull it out, drop it back about 3 inches. You push the dirt up to it and step beside it.
Okay, thank you. Sorry. Thanks for defining that for me. So if your soil's prepared, the only problem, and we've seen this some in nurseries too, when they put whips in, you know, they'll drag, make the hole, put the whip in, sometimes the roots end up going just in one direction. So if your soil is in good shape, and one of the things we talk about is minimizing our disturbance, that would be a way to do it. As long as you can loosen any girdling roots, things that are growing in a circle, or just kind of loosen those up and then so they spread out, and that depending on your soil, if it's heavy clay, sometimes, you know, when we use a shovel or a tool, you end up with a glazed surface, right? And so the roots have a hard time penetrating. You're in Iola, I think I heard. So
Viola.
Okay. So do you have pretty sandy soil there?
Yes, we do in some parts.
Okay. So if your soil's is loamy and has or is sandy, then you'll have less likely you'll get that glazing on the side of that hole that you're digging or that furrow that you're digging. And so those roots will have a better opportunity. So that's my only concern, is make sure those roots are properly placed, have a good start, and can infiltrate the surrounding soil.
Here you go, Eugene.
Thanks much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling.
Eugene.
Appreciate the call. Sandy in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Sandy.
Hello. I would like to know how to boost the productivity of my spring bulbs. The foliage comes up every year, but the blossoms are becoming less and less. I'm wondering if I could fertilize or if it was time to plant new bulbs. What do you think?
Are they all of your bulbs or just your hyacinths and tulips?
Actually, I was always dependent on the daffodils to do really well, but I've noticed that this year they seem to be declining. I know the tulip bulbs, the blossoms seem to get smaller and smaller, but I'm concerned about the daffodils, actually.
Okay, thank you, Sandy. And you're right, just for people maybe new to growing spring flowering bulbs, tulips and hyacinths tend to be short-lived, meaning they give you great flowers maybe for a year or two, and then fewer and fewer every year. And that's just because our growing conditions are suitable but not the best, so we'll often see a decline. For daffodils, a couple things that can happen. This year was crazy, right? We had 80-degree temperatures in some parts of the state. I was speaking in Indiana. I left. My daffodils were showing no color. I came back 36 hours later, and they were in bloom, right? And then it got cold. And so here's the thing, right? Crazy, right? So here's the thing with daffodils, and you know this, Sandy, but for maybe new gardeners, when those flower buds are starting, they just kind of look like a swollen leaf at the tip, right, that bud, and then they start to open. So if we have cold weather after those buds have started to expand, sometimes they're damaged and they can't fully develop, and we lose the blooms for that year. That's one option.
Mm-hmm.
They'll take shady conditions, as you know, and sometimes too much shade can be an issue. And then even though they're good at naturalizing, if they are overcrowded, it might be time to lift and divide them. You can either do that as the leaves begin to decline, mark the location, and do it in the fall. So I think those are some things. Fertilizing can help if you haven't. Usually, if your bulbs are in garden beds, you fertilize normally, they get enough nutrients, or if you add compost on a regular basis. But if they're kind of in beds naturalized and you don't fertilize and, you know, you haven't incorporated compost or spread it on the surface, it wouldn't hurt to do that. The best time is as the leaves emerge. You'll get the best value from doing that. We typically fertilize in fall just out of convenience. We plant them, fertilize, and we're done. So it wouldn't hurt. I would use a low-nitrogen, slow-release fertilizer. As you know, I'm a fan of Milorganite, but it also has some non-leaching phosphorus, and it also, when the microorganisms work on releasing the pellets, it releases some of the phosphorus, good for flowering, and potassium, good for hardiness and disease resistance, that's bound to our soil. So I wouldn't overdo the fertilizer, but it wouldn't hurt if you don't want to use Milorganite, some other low-nitrogen, slow-release, or in the fall if you're planting new bulbs, or next spring as the leaves emerge. Just one of those times should be sufficient.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's take another call. Sue in Westfield, on to you now. Hi, Sue.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering if you could help me. I've been fighting with an arbor that's in a moderately shaded area, and all my climbers just don't do well. And I was wondering if you had any suggestions for something I could plant that would climb up the arbor, be a perennial for zone 5, and tolerate moderate shade.
What have you tried that's failed, Sue?
Well, I had the passion flower in there, which does really great during the year, but does not overwinter. And
right.
I pulled them out and tried to keep them in the basement, but that doesn't seem to work too well. Clematis on there. And I must do something really wrong because I just can't do clematis for anything. So
okay,
any suggestions?
I do. I wanted to just, sometimes when I was teaching, I used to tell my students, indicator plants, you know what certain plants need, and then if you know if they're doing well in that location, it's easier to pick more. So one of my favorites, and mine receives just morning sun, is Major Wheeler Honeysuckle Vine. It's a cultivar of our native honeysuckle vine, deep red blossoms, blooms all summer long. Hummingbirds love it. It does not get powdery mildew like the native honeysuckle vine tends to in shady locations. And it's a vigorous grower, not aggressive like bittersweet, but it'll cover your arbor fairly quickly. And clematis, so that might be one to try, Major Wheeler Honeysuckle Vine. And I'm finding it more and more available. It's hardy to zone 4, I'm pretty sure. That'll make it in your area, no problem. And I had to laugh, Sue. I have a passion flying in my shop area in front of a window. It's alive, but it's not looking pretty right now.
Sue, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We'll take another call in just a second, but just a reminder that our guest today is Melinda Myers, and she'll answer pretty much any of your gardening questions, and I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Maria Lopez, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau's our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Melinda Myers. Again, you can join in with your gardening questions at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Arlene in New Berlin has something for us. Let's go there. Arlene, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Morning, Larry. I greatly appreciate you taking my call. I have daffodils in my front lawn. Now, I decreased the garden in my front because at my age, I can't be crawling around anymore. I was just 83 years old. So I want to move the daffodils. Some of them are still blooming, and some of them have already died, and they get a lot of sun in the morning. And I don't know, I can't cut the lawn where the flowers are, so how do I mark them so that I can get all the bulbs out? And then and at what time do I do this? Do I wait until fall to have somebody dig up the bulbs so that I can move them, like to my backyard where they get a lot of sun all year long? Because sometimes the house kind of shades them. But I mean, they're beautiful. They're still. I've got several plants that are still blooming, and they're really pretty. I have the white and yellow ones, white with the yellow centers, and I don't want to lose them, you know. And it's like, what are you going to do? You know, it frustrates me that I should be able to read and find out what's going on, but
yeah,
I guess I want
to. That's why Larry and I are here.
Yeah, if you read it, you didn't call us.
That's what we're here for.
Yes. Yes.
So I have some helpful tips for you. Obviously, fall is the best time to dig and divide, but it's the hardest time to find them, right? And if it's in your lawn, you can't put a post. So I have moved daffodils in bloom when I've had to, as long as I kept them water and I, you know, took a chunk of the soil with, so you need to prepare, have some topsoil to fill in those holes. I've had success. The better time would be after they're done blooming. You know, daffodil leaves, you know, take forever to die back. But if you can give them a few weeks, you know, or after they're done blooming, give them a few weeks to put some of that energy back. Leave the leaves intact if they're still green and growing, and move them then. I've had pretty good success. As you know, daffodils are tough. The longer you can leave them in place, the better for the bulbs. But it sounds like they're good and healthy, and it sounds like you're a good gardener. So I think if you can give them a few weeks after flowering, 6 would be great, but you probably can't wait to cut your grass that long. Move those, water them in, let them naturally die back, the tops, and you should be in good shape.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Julie in Middleton has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Julie.
Hi. We have new neighbors, and our view from our porch now is where they have odds and ends. And so we're either going to put up a decorative fence or some sort of bushes that would, you know, that, of course, is the slower option, but we don't have a ton of room in between the where our property is and where they have like a shed and stuff. But just wondering if you have any suggestions for something fast growing that would block our, make a nicer view.
And how high would that have to be?
Probably about 6 feet. And if it was much higher than that, it would look silly, I think. There are some bushes I know that almost are conical, almost, you know, straight up and down, vertical, that really make a tight fence, but that wasn't quite what we had in mind.
So thank you for asking that question, Larry. That was on my mind as well. So a couple things you might want to consider. A fence or even a temporary piece of lattice that would give you some immediate benefit, or a trellis that you could train an annual vine and a perennial vine for long term. So, for example, hyacinth bean vine is a very cool annual vine. It has leaves like bean plants. It has purple flowers the hummingbirds love, produces these purple pods. I don't recommend eating them. There, some sources say you have to boil them 3 times, change the water. I'm like, if you have to do that, it's probably, right? So that could give you quick cover while you plant a vine that can then cover that trellis. And then, you know, next year you may not need the annual vine, or maybe the second year you do. And maybe you decide to put an annual and a perennial vine up so that you have, you know, some extended bloom time as well. There are, if it's full sun, but you said evergreens weren't what you were really looking for.
Right.
There are some shrubs. Aronias are kind of slow grower, which are chokeberries, but there are upright kinds. I'll tell you one that's fast, but I don't think it's going to get 6 feet tall. It's more like 5 feet in my garden. But the Kodiak series, check that out. It's a Dervilla, our native bush honeysuckle. It's not the bad kind. They spread pretty rapidly. I had a small sample plant, and 3 years later I had to move it because it grew so fast and big. And there's some that have new leaves that are orange and some that are black and do very well. You may want to do one that's really pretty, will take some shade. It's kind of a spreading plant, is the double file viburnum, which is resistant to the viburnum leaf beetle. So that makes it a good check. It might be a little too wide, but check that out, the double file viburnum. It will take sun to part shade as well. There are, I'll tell you, I like the Bloomerang series of lilacs that get, well, they're about 5 feet. I don't know if those are going to be tall enough for you, but they are like 4 to 5 feet tall and wide, bloom mid-May, and then repeat, not as floriferous in the end of July till frost, but you know what? If you get a second flush, it's always a fun thing. Nine barks, excellent for hot, dry, sunny areas, and there are a variety of those available with interesting leaf color. So nine barks for sun and dry conditions. The chokeberry will take sun or shade, a little moister conditions, a little slower to get started. The bush honeysuckle, full to part sun, that will do well also. Fast grower, maybe a little too vigorous for you. And those are just a few that I would suggest. And then look for some vines, too. Again, some of those perennial vines on a pretty arbor that'll give you some quick, like a quick fix.
And good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dave in Janesville, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. I've got a chestnut that was given to me as a seedling 6-7 years ago, and it's getting very large. I would like it moved with a tree mover. I'm wondering if it's feasible, and because of possible blight, or is it still a desirable tree, or doesn't it have a prayer?
Okay, boy, that's a wide range, and we're gardeners, Dave, so we're always optimistic. You obviously are, because you've been growing. If it's one of the American chestnuts, the blight is still an issue. Janesville, I don't think there are any chestnuts around, so that's a good thing, because then, you know, there's fewer plants to be carrying the disease. You know, I would talk to the place you're hiring to see kind of have they moved them, what kind of success have they had. You know, anytime we move a large tree, it takes a couple years. It just tends to sit there and look like it's doing nothing. Produces leaves, right, but doesn't put on much growth. So it's one of those things. If you could leave it where it was, that would be your best option. Obviously, that sounds like that isn't an option. And then using, you know, a tree that big, I'm guessing you're going to need a tree spade if it's put on enough growth, because you'll need a fairly substantial root ball, you know, to help move it. So, you know, I think you have to weigh is the cost for moving the tree and taking a chance worth it to you? You know, we all have a different level of optimism with our buds, right? So how's that for not really giving you a yay or a nay? Sorry, Dave, but I think it's worth a shot if you don't mind taking a chance and spending the money.
Something to ponder, Dave. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Scott had emailed. He's a no-till, no-chem gardener, and he has quite a few Japanese beetles attacking his pole beans, I'm assuming from last year. He's had some luck using thyme oil to limit damage. Wonders about root vegetables. He's had, and the beetles, he's had some control over them with milky spore. Does milky spore survive in the ground, and how long can you store it?
Good question, Scott. And no-till is one of those things. I think we're all, you know, it sounds like you've been doing it for a while. So Japanese beetles, some years are terrible problems for gardeners. Some years you get a break, but it's never going to go away. So here are a couple things you can do. floating row covers, hard for pole beans, but bush beans a little easier. Beans don't need bees for pollination, so you can cover the plants at planting as long as you're rotating your crops and prevent the Japanese beetles from reaching them, as well as basil. And I'll talk about using row covers for squash vine borer in a second. So physical barriers. There is a product that I know PJ Leash has mentioned, and I've used and I've had other gardeners tell me, called Beetle Juice, J-U-S, or Beetle Gone. And it's a form of Bacillus thuringiensis. It's B.T. Galleria. And it kills beetles. Now, it kills certain beetles, but the label doesn't tell you all of them. But it does. It is labeled for Japanese beetle control of the larva and the adults. And I've had heard fairly good response. So it's considered organic, so it might be something to try. University of Minnesota found if you go after the beetles, like you see the first couple and you get them, you know, off your plants, knock them into a can of soapy water or suck them up with a vacuum and dump them in the soapy water, that then there's less plant damage to attract more Japanese beetles. So you'll reduce the population in your garden. Now, I always have good intentions, but I usually don't get it done that early. So that's why I kind of rely on some of those other things. The adults can fly up to 2 miles. So the milky spore is typically used in lawn areas where, and even gardens that the Japanese beetle grubs can feed in. But when they hatch, those adults can fly up to 2 miles. So you really almost need the whole neighborhood applying it for 100% control. And you can't use insecticides or fungicides in the lawn area where you treat because, one, you need some beetles for the disease to attack and multiply, and you don't want to kill the disease organism. So it's just needs some special attention when you use milky spore. So you might want to try some of those others. The other thing I wanted to mention, Larry, because I was really intrigued with some research, and it was either Iowa or Colorado State or both, where they found if you cover your squash plants at planting, and even your cucumbers, if you cover them at planting, leave the row cover on until you get both male and female flowers. Then, of course, you have to remove it because, you know, they need bees to pollinate. They found a reduction in squash bug populations and squash vine borer, and also cucumber beetles carrying the bacterial wilt on cucumbers. And I thought, you know, that's a great option for people trying to avoid using chemicals but struggling with squash vine borer. Now, they do overwinter in the soil and compost, so you want to make sure don't plant your squash and cucumbers in the same place where they were infected last year by those insects. So just something to consider for people looking for some alternatives.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't seen that. Well, I learn something new every time I'm on the show.
I do too.
I just learned something else. Thanks. Thanks for that, Melinda. Ron in Manitowoc County has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Ron.
Thanks, Larry. I'm wondering if the small nodules that are on gladiola corms in fall, when you dig them up, can be used to produce new plants, and if so, how is it done?
Question. Those are called cormels. It sounds like a candy, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the bulblets we get off of our bulbs. It takes several years, so you would just remove them. I think corms are kind of cool because the old one dies, forms a new one on top, right? So you sometimes see the shriveled up original bulb, then you see the big or corm, then you see the bigger one and all those little nodules, as you mentioned. So you could take those off, and what I would do is plant them in maybe a part of your garden where you can kind of maybe use them as a nursing or a nursery area. Plant them because it's going to take several years for them to reach a good size that they'll start flowering. So it's not for impatient gardeners, but it's kind of those of us that like to experiment. It's a fun way to do it. So as you're cleaning them up or bringing them out to plant this year, maybe plant those little ones in another area where you can kind of keep an eye on them, where it doesn't matter that there's smaller leaves and no blooms, and then just repeat until you get a good-sized plant. You know, probably about 3 years it'll take for them to start flowering.
There you go, Ron. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Sue in McGuanago emailed. She's planning to plant veggies in an 8x2 raised cedar bed. Wondering if what's the safest non-toxic liner to line the bed with, and what's the best soil to use that is non-toxic, of course. Some bag soils, she understands, have heavy metals in them like lead.
You know, there's a couple things, and this is, you know, we keep learning so much more about what we're doing wrong that we didn't realize, or products that we thought were safe, and we're finding more ways to detect their long-term impact. So a couple things. One, when I did my raised beds that I didn't think about doing was lining them with hardware cloth. I have a terrible – I live in outside of McGuanago, so Sue – I can relate. And the ground squirrels are awful. And no, it wouldn't prevent them from digging from the top down, but now they have these tunnels going from underground to the top and back, and they have much easier access. And I read about this after, of course, I filled my raised beds with my planting mix. Right? Isn't it the way it always happens? You could line it with landscape fabric. 8x2, depending on if it's deep enough. We want at least 12, preferably 15 inches depth for those plants to root. A lot of times we like it right over soil, so even if you had hardware cloth, some of those roots could penetrate the soil below. Landscape fabric will help contain the potting mix or the raised bed mix in terms of, you know, if it from spilling out the bottom if it's on a hard surface. What some people do is they do lasagna or hukoculture garden in their raised bed frames, and so they use landscape trimmings and plant-based kitchen scraps to create their soil. I've done lasagna gardening in my garden, just raised beds, no form, and it's just basically composting. So I'll put newspaper on the first, some compost, some 8 to 10 inches of, you know, compostable materials, fall leaves, grass clippings not treated with an herbicide, kitchen scraps from plant material, layer of compost, some fertilizer. Do this till you fill your bed. And I've planted immediately and had a great garden. It will settle, so you'll need to do this every year. So that's one option. Another option is if you're buying bag soil, you know, I think you just have to go on and just do, you know, do a review. I think one of the things of some of these online sources is a lot of gardeners provide impact. Anything can be put in a bag and sold, but look for OMRI, O-M-R-I, certification for organic mixes. That means they've been reviewed and evaluated. And so that might be your best option. And then you may have to amend with some compost. You know, we all garden differently. I feel your pain. It's always a struggle to find a product that works well and is safe. But look for that O-M-R-I, either the initials or the icon on the bag of compost or potting mix that you select, and that will at least give you a sense that it's an organic mix that's been reviewed and certified.
Yep, good advice. Let's take a call from James in Kenosha next. Hi, James.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. In Kenosha, we've got the yard waste drop-off. Everybody takes their lawn clippings and debris and whatnot. They turn that in... Pardon me, they turn that into compost. I plan on using a lot of that in the vegetable gardens. I wonder if there's anything that I need to know, or is it okay to use municipal compost in that way?
You know, one of the things you may want to do, because every municipality treats and manages their yard waste differently, and honestly, I think it's gotten much better. We used to use a lot of it long ago when I was an extension agent in our community gardens. And some municipalities provided better products than others. I know there's one, you have to be a resident, that uses those white tubes that farmers put their bales of straw, their round bales of hay in, and they inject a fertilizer and air, and boy, the product comes out. You know, it's been heated, so it's killed a lot of the weeds, disease organisms. You know, I always worry about jumping worms. You know, it becomes such a big issue.
And so I think I would call your Department of Public Works and just ask some of those questions. How are you managing the compost? Are you finding any problems with disease organisms or insects or jumping worms? I've used some in the past in the community garden program. And again, I talk to gardeners from different municipalities, and some have really good products. They have great success. So you also might want to talk to some of your gardening friends. It's an important that we recycle this product and put it back to use. And I think the more questions we ask the people that are managing, they may not like me, but I think the more questions we ask, the better job they can do with our support to provide a product that's good for your garden.
Yeah, absolutely. James Goodluck, thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Todd in De Pere next. Hi, Todd.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about pollinator plants. For example, I have flats of red milkweed or swamp milkweed. I'm starting. They've been in about 3 to 4 weeks. They're about 3 inches tall, 72 cells per flat. They're looking kind of leggy. I hope to raise them healthy enough to give away, hoping that people will plant them. Any tips on how to make a healthy red milkweed plant?
First of all, congratulations. You got them up. Thank you for spreading them around. And I heard Larry one time on Garden Talk say he just gives his plants a little brush every time he walks by his seedlings, because there has been research that movement helps stimulate thicker, stouter growth. Some gardeners even put a little fan on them. I'm kind of doing the Larry Mueller method. I just kind of give mine a brush when I walk by. Good sunlight or artificial light, I'll tell you, LED lights are pretty intense. Fluorescence will work as well. But if you have lights, I like to do artificial light and natural light, because then you get the best of both worlds. So, increasing the light, if you don't have them under artificial light, is another option. And then they will benefit, depending on your potting mix. A lot of seed starting mixes don't hold a lot of nutrients, so a very dilute solution of a fertilizer would help promote more robust growth. But it sounds like you're off to a good start.
Yeah, it sure does. Todd, thanks very much for calling. Good luck with that. Melinda Myers, our guest today. It's great to have her with us on this edition of Garden Talk. Questions for her, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking with Melinda Myers and taking your emails and your calls. I'm glad to see so many people interested in talking on the show today. And Deb in Eau Claire is one of them. So let's just go to Deb and find out what's on Deb's mind.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, good. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm calling about tomato plants. I grow mine from seed. I started them at the end of March, but I know you're supposed to rotate where you plant your tomatoes, only I have such a tiny little space in my city lot. So how much do I need to rotate? Can I just do every other year? Should it be longer? That's my question. Tomato rotation.
Yeah, I was a small space gardener for 26 years, and I grew eggplant, tomato, and peppers in the same bed, which they're all related, and rotating, you should rotate out of family. So I understand your problem. I rotated from one end to the other, and basically I had good soil. I made sure I had well amended with compost, which promotes healthy growth. And I was lucky enough not to have disease problems. Yes, it would be great. The recommended time is like a 3-year break, so tomatoes followed by something unrelated like onions or beans, followed by something unrelated like lettuce.
and then back in. The reality is, Deb, sometimes you just can't do it. So the healthier your soil, the better. And depending, I know we all have our favorite tomato varieties, but there are more and more coming out that have multiple disease resistance, so that always helps. So if you like the flavor and you see they have, you know, resistant to several strains of verticillium and fusarium wilt and some of the other diseases, those might be some to try. If you end up with problems, you may have to rotate into a container. The other thing I did is I mixed my vegetables in with my flowers in my garden out front, and my neighbors thought I was a great cook because I had herbs and veggies in there. But it was a sunny spot, and it was a way I could plant in different locations. So it sounds like you kind of had the same deal I did. So work on your soil. Healthy soil is going to promote healthy growth. You all know, you probably know this, but towering to increase airflow, make sure they have plenty of sunlight. You know, mulching the soil with leaves that you've collected from your yard, evergreen needles to kind of, you know, keep some of those soil diseases in the soil, suppress weeds, conserve moisture. As they break down, they improve the soil. And those are all ways you can help get, really create healthy soil, and reduce the risk of disease. So 3 years if you have the space, but if you don't, just try to build that soil.
Good luck, Deb. Thank you so much for calling. Ron in Chippewa Falls, on to you now. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I do not have a green thumb, but I have a very healthy bed of lilies of the valley. Most of my neighbors would like to see me kill them, but I wondered, what can I do to, they're very healthy, but what can I do to fertilize them?
You may not need to fertilize them, Ron. And I just want to warn, lily of the valleys are considered invasive plants, so you're keeping them contained. And that's, your neighbors are probably afraid, because once they get going, as you found, they can really take over. So unless they're showing signs that they need improved blooming or they're not growing and spreading the way you would like, I wouldn't do any fertilizing. Use a mulch to just help improve the soil. Make sure they stay contained. You might want to remove the faded flower so the seeds don't spread to areas you and others don't want. And I think you're good. Otherwise, you know, I would use a low-nitrogen, slow-release fertilizer, but only if you need to. And if they're growing healthy and blooming great, again, you know, just kind of saying, folks that don't have them may not want to add them because they are pretty aggressive and considered invasive, but you want to just make sure that, you know, you don't fertilize unless you need to. And it sounds like they may be getting enough from whatever else you're doing in the area, and they're doing fine.
Yeah, there you go, Ron. Thank you. Brian in Menominee Falls, maybe?
Hello.
Hi, thanks for calling.
Hey, I just moved into a new property, and I do not have a garden, and I want to raise tomato plants. How much soil do I need to build a raised garden?
Good question. So a couple things you may want to do. If you're going to use a raised bed frame, you know, cut the grass and not remove the grass. Cut the grass really short in the area you're going to build your garden or plant your tomato and make your raised bed. Cover it with newspaper, and if you have at least 12 to 15 inches is kind of a good depth for a raised bed if you're not counting on the soil beneath. Some people will remove the sod and then build their raised bed over it, and then they can get by with like 8 to 10 inches because the tomatoes will root into the soil below. And then for those of you that may also be starting something new, Brian, I know you have space in your on your new property. Congratulations. But a 5-gallon bucket works great. Drill some holes in the bottom for people that maybe are trying to grow tomatoes on a balcony or a deck. And that works great for the bigger ones, and a couple-gallon pot for smaller ones. So if you can give it at least 12, preferably 15 inches deep, if it's not connected to the soil below.
There you go. Good luck, Brian. Thank you so much for calling. John in Appleton, we'll go to you now. Hi, John.
Good morning. Yes, I have an azalea plant that was planted in my yard maybe 10 years ago, and it bloomed when we first got it, but it's looking pretty sad. It hasn't bloomed in years. It's got 12 leaves on it or something. And I don't know where to start. I mean, fertilizer, do I have to check the soil? I don't know where to start.
Azaleas and rhododendrons are challenging plants to grow here in Wisconsin. They like moist, well-drained acidic acid. And most of the soils, if not all in the Appleton area, are like those in the southeast that tend to be very sweet or have a high pH. So there's your first challenge. And then having great organically rich soil so that they stay moist but they're well-drained. They also need shade from or shelter from winter wind and winter sun because winters are hard. Even though azaleas lose their leaves, they set their flower buds in advance. And so even a little afternoon shade in the summer, especially as our summer has been pretty toasty lately, will help. If the leaves are looking pale, again, I would recommend, if you're going to fertilize, one of the things we found that we don't like to push a lot of new growth when we're helping plants recover. You know, so a tree is struggling. The last thing we want it to do is put out a lot of new growth that the roots are going to have to support when they can't support what's there. So a low nitrogen, slow release fertilizer. You know, I work with Milorganite, so I always like to disclose that. That would be a choice I would recommend if you're going to fertilize. Again, making sure you have organic mulches on the soil. It'll help keep the roots cool and moist as they break down. It adds organic matter and nutrients to the soil as well. And, you know, there are some newer varieties that are a little more hardy and tolerant of the northern areas. But, you know, it sounds like it's worth the effort for you to try to get this going. So I would try, you know, pulling any grass, if there's grass or weeds growing around it, remove those, mulch, add some mulch, and then if you want, fertilize with a low nitrogen, slow release fertilizer, just once, and that should help. If it's chlorotic, meaning the leaves are kind of a pale or yellow and the veins are dark green, that's usually a sign that iron and manganese are deficient. And so one of the benefits is Milorganite has chelated iron, so that might help with the greening. Or you may need to use a plant for acid, a fertilizer for acid-loving plants. But I would start with a low nitrogen, slow release, do the mulching, watch the moisture if we have another hot, dry summer, and see how it goes there. And then you can try the next step of using an acidifying fertilizer, fertilizer for acid-loving plants.
For calling. Jody in Brooklyn, Wisconsin. We'll go to you now. Hi, Jody.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. One, last year I had planted plain old green beans several times without much success, and I knew of others that had the same problem, and I wondered if there was a common issue or something we should know about. And then my second question, which was touched on earlier, was jumping beans. I heard something recently about that, and it made me wonder why we don't know more and what we can do to prevent the spread of those.
Good questions, Jody. So for green beans, so when temperatures are high, it can interfere with green beans, a couple things. Cool, wet springs, if the soil's cool and we plant our beans and corn, if you're growing corn, if the soil's cool and the seeds are slow to sprout, corn root maggot is one of the insects that will damage those and prevent germination and can also cause those seedlings to be deformed. Usually just waiting a couple weeks to plant once the soil's warmer will help. Stress plants, maybe from the heat, could be a problem. I'm not aware of any insects or disease. Larry, you
no.
talked to all the experts all
no.
year round, so you hadn't heard anything either.
You are on the right track.
Okay, good. I always count on you because you remember all this and know so much, so thank you. The other thing I'm guessing you were talking about, so I think I'd give it a try. Every year is different. Kind of monitor when you say no success. If it's a lack of sprouting, the cool, wet soils could be the issue. If it was happening during the hot, dry summer, the stress on the plants could be the issue. If this happens again, kind of, you know, I know you can send images in to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, and the more information you provide, the better. They've got great resources. And Brian has that. His team has that cool Plant Disease Medallion Project, and I'm saying this wrong, where you can study their fact sheets and earn a medallion so you can learn something and have fun. So you can always check that. Jumping worms, I think you meant, you were talking about jumping worms.
Yeah.
There's research happening. They have not found a solution. UW-Madison Arboretum, I think his name is Brad Herrick, has a great video, YouTube video, on jumping worms. There's not a solution, but he talks about the life cycle and things we can do to prevent it, such as don't share plants. If you have jumping worms, don't share plants. And if you have jumping worms, you'll probably know because they overwinter as eggs or cocoons the size of a mustard seed. The adults will grow and get pretty big over the summer. They devour organic matter. And so that really messes your soil structure and really a concern in our natural areas. Avoid sharing plants. When you buy compost or mulch, ask how they manage jumping worms. And if they go, huh, you might want to consider another provider. And I found that to be the case. So I've kept my soil. I haven't amended my soil because I haven't found a good source other than my own, making my own, which limits what you can do.
And at this moment, we have to remind you that Melinda Myers, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for spending some of your day with us and with Melinda Myers, our guest, nationally known gardening expert. Take a look at her website, melindamyers.com, and you're going to find a lot of great information there, as well as information, I believe, about those videos that she's and webinars that she's putting together in association with our libraries across the state of Wisconsin. So always great to have her with us. Questions for her, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Phil in Madison. Well, wait a minute. Before we do that, I know, Melinda, you were kind of finishing up on a comment at the top of the hour, and I'm not sure you were completely done with it.
You know, thanks. Sorry, I got so excited. I try to keep an eye on the time. So thanks, Larry, for being patient with me. I think basically I just want to remind people there's good information from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources on jumping worms, UW-Madison Arboretum. Check out that YouTube video. Brad Herrick does a great job of explaining how to identify the kind of damage. And then just reiterating, you know, don't share plants. Don't accept them. Jeff Epping, who is a former, I think he's still with Olbrich, or he might have retired.
No, he's still there.
He's still there. Okay, I know he was. I heard a rumor he was retiring. I was like, wow. And he's said one of the saddest thing for him about having jumping worms is he couldn't share his plants, and I have to agree with him because gardeners love to share. Check your sources, and then they are doing research. It's just finding a solution is tough because there's so many good guys in our soil that, you know, when you try to kill just the bad ones, you can often damage your plants. You can damage some of the good organisms. And I worry about the toads and frogs and things like that. So I think just keep an eye out for information and see how things develop.
And now let's go to Phil in Madison. Phil, thank you so much for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is about phosphorus. I have a sort of ongoing compost pile in the backyard that we feed every year. It's mostly food scraps in the summer, but then I put some shredded leaves in it in the fall and occasionally some sawdust from my workshop. I don't use any commercial fertilizers or anything on the yard. Sometimes I put some lawn grass clippings in it. The problem is, if it's a problem, is it's off the charts on phosphorus. And I did a home do-it-yourself test, and got that, thought, well, maybe that's not right. I sent some to the extension service, and they said the same thing. And I know that one of the things that can be a problem with phosphorus, supposedly, is that it prevents uptake of iron and zinc. Last year, I tried using some liquid iron foliar feeding on some plants, and it really seemed to make a difference. So my question, I guess, is why do you think I would have so much phosphorus in there, and is there anything at all I can do about it?
This up because our soils tend to be high in phosphorus and potassium in general. So years of using complete fertilizers, not necessarily you, but others, 10-10-10, 20-20-20, you know, that seems to be an issue. Phosphorus is bound to the soil, used in much smaller amounts than nitrogen. And so that's often why I like fertilizers, whether you're using an organic product, a compost. You can always have your compost tested by the soils lab, but usually compost is not causing a problem with excessive levels. It's and there's not much you can do to take it out, but not adding more is helpful. I mentioned earlier that Milorganite, some of the research found done by University of Florida, that the microorganisms, when they work on releasing the nutrients from Milorganite, also release some of the phosphorus and potassium bound to the soil. You may find that also the fact that you're using compost, sometimes that activity, the microorganisms can perhaps do the same thing. There's not a lot of, I haven't seen research that backs it, but I see a lot of similar results in plant growth. So adding chelated iron as a foliar, iron as a foliar feed, if your plants are showing deficiency, the pH chart is really kind of interesting because you're right. The higher the pH, it, iron, manganese, some other micronutrients are not readily available to the plant but bound to the soil. If your plants are doing fine, I wouldn't be concerned, but I would be careful not to add more, which it sounds like you're just using your compost. And so if it's broken down and in a fine form, it shouldn't be an issue. And just there's not much you can do, but other than, you know, it sounds like if it's down into compost, it's there. And so I think you probably are good. You just may need to either use some nitrogen fertilizer to supplement if you're seeing the foliar spray. As you know, it may enters through the leaves, very small amounts, not as efficient as adding chelated iron or manganese to the soil, but it's absorbed by the plant directly, so it doesn't have a chance to be bound to the soil. So it's a complicated issue. You might want to have your compost tested just to see. I'm not sure what I would recommend doing differently. You may want to up your nitrogen a bit. Food scraps are pretty high in nitrogen, though. Fall leaves are good carbon sources, as is sawdust as well. So it sounds like you're doing everything right, and I'm not sure how you could change it to make it different. So if you don't have a problem, I wouldn't worry about it. If you are experiencing a problem, that might be something, if you have your compost pile tested or you send in another soil test, to ask the soils lab, because some of the on the form, as you know, you can identify I'm having these problems. But I think as long as your plants are performing well, and last year was a tough year. It was so hot in much of the state. And down in the south, we were really lacking a lot of regular rainfall, that it could be a coincidence that you added that foliar feed and the plants improved.
Yeah, there you go, Phil. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, let's go to Carol in Crandon, Wisconsin next. Hi, Carol.
Oh, hi, Larry. I'm not sure you'll be able to help me. I have a son who lives in Rubicon, Wisconsin, who's dealing with a number of disabilities, and he used to be able to plant a few larger tomato varieties in his ground, but he is unable to do that. And I wonder if Master Gardeners, or there's some organization he could contact with, perhaps there would be volunteers that would help him either plant one or two tomato plants, either in his ground or in containers. I could leave my cell phone number with one of your operators.
Well, what do you think, Melinda?
Well, a couple things I would suggest. I would contact your local county extension office, and if they have a Master Gardener program, they could funnel your request to them. They may also have some local resources. I know there are groups that will donate time and energy. There may be somebody, I'm thinking of some of the groups in the southeast Wisconsin area that often provide services or resources or team up volunteers. There are some online sources where you can access volunteers that sometimes people are looking for it. I know you're not there by him, but if he's got any gardening neighbors, that's always a good place to start, because most gardeners are happy to help fellow gardeners. When my dad was limited to a wheelchair, well, we put the plants in containers right by his ramp, but the neighbor helped him, if he needed it, to get things done. And so sometimes your neighbors are willing to help too, especially if you're just talking a couple of tomatoes. So, Larry, yeah. You have any other thoughts?
No, I think that's all really good advice. I'd certainly look at the neighbors, but I'd also get a hold of the county extension office there and the Master Gardener program. I got to believe there'd be somebody that from the Master Gardeners or from one of the other local groups that would help with this, even Scouts.
Oh, Scouts is a great idea. Gardeners are some of the most kind and generous people out there. They like to share plants and information. So,
good luck, Carol. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Stan in Green Bay, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Stan.
Yeah, hi. Melinda, we met years ago up in Green Bay. You were doing an event at Science, and you gave me a lot of good advice. So I'm back again.
Oh, good. Thanks.
Rose of Sharon. I used to have a whole backyard of it when I lived in Lincoln, Nebraska. They came back. I never did anything. Just came back without any problem. Now up in Green Bay, I'm lucky to get 2 years out of it, and then the winter just wipes it out. Is there anything I can do to get my Rose of Sharon to come back? And I've tried about 6 or 7 different varieties.
When I first started my career many years ago, and Rose of Sharon are such a nice end-of-the-season kind of plant. The hummingbirds love them. We love them. And then we'd have a hard winter, and they die. And then people would be reluctant to plant again, and then I'd start seeing more and more, and then we'd have another hard winter. And now what's happening is, it was a mild winter. However, we had that cold snap early, so, plants didn't have a chance to harden off. And so I'm curious to see what we're going to end up with this year. Last year we had similar kind of crazy extreme temperature fluctuation and lost some things that I was surprised about. So there's my excuse, Stan, for if they die. But a couple things you might want to do. If you have a sheltered location in your landscape, might be a way to increase the success. You may even want to look at, winter mulching is a problem with trees and shrubs because you're providing great places for the voles. So unless you put hardware cloth to keep out the voles and the rabbits and, adding a little extra insulation, tree wraps don't really provide a lot of protection from those fluctuating temperatures. Summer care is the best thing, which you're probably doing, Stan. And I don't really have those. Oh, these are the 5 toughest or hardiest of the Rose of Sharon. And I think part of it is that fluctuating, we get the warm, the cold, the warm, the cold that really stresses them out. So, one, I give you credit for continuing to try. And two, I think, it might be some selection yourself just saying, okay, these made it, these didn't. We'll add more of that variety and kind of slowly build your collection that way.
Yeah, good luck, Stan.
Yeah. I hope you'll call again, even though this wasn't real helpful advice.
Thanks for calling. Oh, man. Oh, Edna Ann in Retreat, Wisconsin, emailed to ask for the name of those 2 Japanese beetle products you mentioned earlier.
Beetle juice, J-U-S. You can tell how old that person who named it is, right?
Yeah.
They watched the movie. Or Beetle Gone, G-O-N-E.
I don't know of any local retailers that are selling it, so you'll probably have to order it online.
Yeah, I think you're right. Jackie emailed, she lives in northern Minnesota, zone 3, rotates the vegetables in her garden every year, and would like to know what she should do to keep the soil healthy.
Great question. Great question. So, you know, as we go to more no-till digging methods, research out of, I think it was Cornell, found that even just adding a quarter inch of compost, a little bit more if you're growing perennials and for your vegetables, anytime you can top dress your garden with compost, the microorganisms, the ground beetles, and things will take it down and help amend the soil. Compost is just really amazing in terms of improving drainage, water holding ability, and then promoting healthy growth that's more resistant. Some gardeners are using, there are several different no-dig methods. Some gardeners are using cardboard or newspaper, remove the staples and the tape and spread it on the soil. And there's a guy out of England, Charles, I forget his last name, and he puts 8 inches of compost on and plants in that. And then the next year he adds a couple inches every year and he builds the soil that way so he's not tilling it. The problem is, where do you get all that compost,
yeah,
right? Organic mulches, anytime you can use organic mulches. So those fall leaves that always seem to collect by the fence or someplace, use them as mulch in the garden. It suppresses weeds as they break down and improves grass clippings not treated with a weed killer. Evergreen needles are slow to break down. They don't make your soil too acidic. They're great to walk on barefoot. And so a lot of people will use those, rake some of them from under their evergreens and use those. And so cover crops are another option. And I'll be really honest, it's one of those areas I need to gain more experience. You know, it's an old technique. So when you harvest your tomatoes, you put in an annual cover crop. One option is to till it in the spring, which defeats the no-till method. Another is to use annual crops that die back. You cut it back, and then you just plant in between the dead plants. You want to avoid things that are, you know, clover is a great cover crop, but it's aggressive, and it may end up taking over the garden. So cover cropping is another good option. I think the University of Minnesota, I think I found on their website some good information on cover cropping, too. So you might want to check that out.
Well, kind of to go along with that, Scott in Green Bay emailed that he uses his last year's stockpile of leaves after they've been processed by his 11 chickens.
Oh, wow.
And then he puts that he calls it, he and his neighbor call it chicken fluff. And they put that between between his rows, and he says, this, of course, it's great for weed suppression, adds organic matter to the soil, as if you needed another excuse to raise chickens.
I love it. That's great. And a little nitrogen to go along with that poop.
a lot of it. I probably mentioned to you before, but I... years back when I moved, I was renting a place, and the right next to it had been a chicken coop, and that's where I got to put a garden in. Oh, my goodness me. The nitrogen in that soil was something else, and I had some bumper crops there right off the bat. Oh, man. Jackie in East Troy, your turn. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. I inherited my husband's raised bed asparagus patches after he passed away. I know nothing about it. I do weed them, but then as soon as I weed them, then all the weeds come right back again. I read somewhere that to put down crabgrass and foxtail herbicidal weed control. Can you help me?
Well, you know, I think weeds are, asparagus from the garden is so great. Weeds, I feel your pain because I get a weed and I swear before I walk out of the area where my garden is, weeds
They're
are back.
Back.
I would not use those chemicals. I'm guessing what somebody recommended may have been like a total vegetation killer, which if you use, the concern I have is it's most effective when temperatures are 55 or above, I think is what the label says. And at that point, your asparagus might be peeking through, especially in a raised bed. And so if you hit that, you know, that spear may be just at the surface, and if that gets hit with the herbicide, that can travel down and kill the root. So you have to be very careful and read and follow label directions if you opt for that. Mulching will help with annual weeds. I'll tell you, I totally, you know, some people will wipe on those total vegetation killers on the leaves of like the quack grass or the bindweed, and being careful not to hit their asparagus. Again, this is a personal choice. If you want to use synthetic herbicides in your food garden, just follow the label. The organic grass killers only burn off the tops, and so it won't kill the roots, so you'll need to apply those several times during the growing season. Just a couple other things, advice in the fall. If you haven't had problems with asparagus beetles, leave those stems stand and then prune them back and clean them out in early spring. You may need to, depending on the soil in that raised bed, add a little bit of either aged manure, a low nitrogen, or an organic fertilizer to the soil. Asparagus is very drought tolerant, and once established, doesn't need a whole lot of nutrients. You know, some of the best right. patches I've seen, right, are grown along the road.
Yep.
And so I feel your pain. I think weeds are the biggest problem on asparagus because it's just tough. So I think it's a way to take out your frustration. When I'm having a bad day, that's usually when I go weed my asparagus patch.
Jackie, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Somebody else wondering, what vegetables have the biggest bang for your buck?
You know, that's a great question. So when time, space, and money are limited, look at the payback. You know, sweet corn is fun to grow, but you only get one or two ears, right? And you need a 4x4 patch. Some tomato varieties produce as much as 8 pounds per plant. I grow yellow apple, which is a small, sweet cherry tomato, kind of the shape of an apple, and the marketing material says 1,000 per plant. I think it's 2,000. Only growing one of those this year.
Which pepper, one was that again?
That's yellow apple tomato.
Oh, okay.
Yellow apple, so you have to try that. And then peppers tend to be a little pricey. And then greens are more nutritious and also more economical. And, you know, get the cut-and-come varieties, those leaf lettuce that you harvest the outer leaves, and then they'll produce more. That's a more economical plant as well. Now, when my daughter was little, she wanted to grow popcorn in our small city lot, and because, oh, my daughter wants to garden, you know, one of those, we gave her the space to grow, and we didn't get a big harvest, but it was an experience for her to do something she wanted to grow, and now she's a gardener as an adult. So it took a few years, but it caught on.
Oh, man. Well, I'm thinking about raising or growing some houseplants after reading that some houseplants are now going for $16,000 for a single plant. We can talk about that another time.
I'm with you, Larry. Not in my budget either. We were going to have to do something.
Melinda, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Always my pleasure. Thank you, Larry, and to all your listeners as well.
Melinda Myers. Take a look at her website, melindamyers.com. Always great to talk with her. Thank you so much for listening. We'll talk on Monday with the editor, Mike Bino, of our Wisconsin magazine, and then Victoria Houston's back with her latest Lou Ferris mystery series. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.